there's a lengthy story, and we're not going to go into great detail here, but in chapter 5, as I mentioned, that the Samaritans did then again get up in arms. The building had been stopped in chapter 4, verse 24, so we get the time setting of Ezra and whatever. It had been stopped until 520. The Samaritans, when they start building again, we read in chapter 5, verse 1 of Ezra, then the prophets Haggai and Zechariah, the son of Iddo, prophesied to the Jews that were in Judah and Jerusalem in the name of the God of Israel, even to them. They rose up Zerubbabel and Joshua. Verse 3, we see the governors came up. These are the governors of Samaria, I believe. And they write Darius anyway. They're really upset. Well, how can they rebuild this temple? There's a law that says you can't do this. They send then this letter to Darius. In verse 8, that, you know, how can this be done? They're laying the walls. The work goes fast on and prospers in their hands. Then asked we those elders and said, who commanded you to build this house? We asked their names also. We write the names and the men that were chief. So he says, now here's the names of all them doing it. It's against the law. Darius, you have to do something. Verse 11. And thus they returned an answer, saying, we are the servants of the God of heaven and earth. Now, again, they're writing this letter to try to get the building stopped. The idea behind it was, well, look what these people, there's an insurrection going on. They're trying to establish the kingdom, and they're going to take over the kingdom, and therefore no longer be servants. They're not going to pay taxes to you and whatever. You've got to obliterate them. Verse 13, they go on with their letter, but in the first year of Cyrus, the king of Babylon, the same king Cyrus made a decree to build this house of God. And apparently this Darius related to Cyrus, your background. I mean, they really, really hit Darius with what he's got to do. And then they want him to do, let's see, I think I got messed up in the story. Let's see. Okay, yeah, their letter to Darius is in verse 6. Okay, yeah, that is the letter that goes out. Chapter 7, then, is Darius the king made a decree. The search was made in the House of the Rolls to find this decree, that Cyrus allowed it to be built, and that the expenses were to be taken out of the king's hand. So on and on this debate goes, and then we have the decree of Darius, chapter 6, verse 8. Verse 6, let's pick it up there. Now therefore Tatnai, who is the governor that was involved in chapter 5 or 6, and your companions, let the work of this house of God alone. Verse 7, let the governor of the Jews and the elders of the Jews build this house of God in his place. So they were told, cease and desist, go ahead and allow them to do the rebuilding. Moreover, I make a decree, what you shall do to the elders of those Jews for the building of this house of God, that of the king's goods, even of the tribute beyond the river, forthwith expenses shall be given. And he goes on and on about that. Verse 11, also I made a decree that whosoever shall alter this word, anybody who fights against the building of this house, let timber be pulled down from his house and being set up, let him be hanged thereon. Let his house be made a dunghill for this. So, you know, what was a law against building now becomes a law against stopping the building. We went through similar situations back in 79 and 80 and, you know, laws that were kind of passed and, well, you got to do it this way. We said, no, we feel that that's religious discrimination. We feel that should be changed. In turn, eventually then those laws got changed and altered for the sake of the work, for the work to be done. So anyway, that's some of the background. You can go through that in greater detail. Verse 14 of chapter 6, the elders of the Jews built, and they prospered through the prophesying of Haggai the prophet and Zechariah the son of Iddo. They built, and they finished it according to the commandment of the God of Israel. And that kind of jumps to the finish in verse 15, that they finished it on the third day of the month of Adar in the sixth year of the reign of Darius the king. Therefore, in my mind, if you go from the second year of Darius as 520 to the sixth, then you're talking, you know, then exactly which, you know, aspect, 616, 615 in that time frame. Okay, we're back to Haggai then. But that is the background. Then we come to the second prophecy. Question?
Yes, when it's talking about the sixth month and the seventh month, is this reckoning according to the Jewish calendar or some other calendar? And also, is it the Cyril or Sabre?
Thank you, John. All these details. That would be an excellent question for Mr. Kaplan. Okay? Why don't you tell me then what he has to say? I might ask him. But I think my belief is, and you know, my answer would be if I didn't have Mr. Kaplan to call upon, and I will bow to his Hebrew books and whatever he's got in his office, goes back to this, but that it is sacred reckoning on, you know, according to God's calendar, that's in the sixth month and whatever, it's, you know, at that point.
We've been more Jewish than that, but the same thing.
Okay, good, thank you. Okay. Chapter 2, then, we pick up the seventh month, the 21st day. Yeah, it would be the sacred time, because what day is this? Seventh month, 21st day. Last day of the Feast of Tabernacles. Not the last great day, right? The last great day is the 22nd day. So this is the last day of the Feast of Tabernacles. Not a holy day, per se, but a very important day as we see this this prophecy. Which, boy, wouldn't that make a great sermon for the last day of the Feast of Tabernacles if I give one? I am going to be going to England for, I'm going to the United Kingdom. I say England. I mean, that could be more than, I guess, just England, couldn't it? Correct me if I'm wrong. Okay, United Kingdom, I'm going for the feast, and where I'm going to be and whatever, I don't know. Okay, something that might be seen within the text is we end up with verse 15 of chapter 1, the 4th and 24th day of the 6th month. Let's jump ahead to chapter 2, verse 10. 24th month, or 24th day of the 9th month. So we see 3 months goes by. The word of the Eternal by Haggai the prophet says, thus says the Eternal of hosts, ask now the priests concerning the law. What are they doing? We'll see when we get to that they weren't properly serving God in the jobs they were supposed to do. God does not immediately bless the people because they started work. That's the point I want to make in chapter 1. We see that 3 months later there are some questions about it. Verse 18 of chapter 2. Consider now from this day upward, from the 4th and 20th day of the 9th month, from the day of the foundation of the Eternal's temple was laid, consider it. Is the seed yet in the barn? Yes, in the vine and the fig tree. Verse 19 at the end. From this day will I bless you. An important principle in the book of Haggai is don't decide, okay, I'm going to make some changes in my life. Today, you know, let's say an alcoholic decides, today I'm not going to take a drink and, you know, I'm obeying God, and then expects all the problems to be over in his life, tremendous blessings to be poured out from that day. The blessings don't necessarily come the day you start the work. We have to then continue in faith that you work that next day, the second day, and the third day, you know, and you work. It's not that God doesn't forgive. God does forgive, but the aspects of what then comes with that, don't be disconsolate if something doesn't happen immediately, is my point. God says that when they finally got their act together, yeah, it was good that they started working, but they still had some things they had to think through. So as they took the step of starting to put the building together, and they took the next step of properly worshiping, and they'll talk about the priests and what they're doing, we get a little bit more of the act together. Finally, we get to the point that the people are starting to obey God enough. They're not perfect yet, right? But enough, and with a commitment that now God can bless them. So we mentioned that procrastination is contagious. Obedience can also be contagious. The fact that, okay, if we're doing what's right and we get, and some blessings start coming, then that is contagious. So, you know, we kind of choose which direction we're going. Now, procrastination is not necessarily a sin, depending on what you're procrastinating about. But I keep putting off doing any real study on that, so I can't really speak any deeper to it. There are some things that you put off that are a sin, okay? In those situations, procrastination would be a sin. God, anyway, needed to see the deep commitment of the people, that it wasn't just something, you know, oh, okay, we'll start working, and now we expect, you know, $50 an hour in return or something, whatever. God wanted to see that they were going to obey Him because they loved God, not just because they were getting big bucks. You know, because they were getting three times as much as they sent in tithes. It didn't always work that way. You know, there are other blessings. We get spiritual blessings. I suppose if you could prove physically that everybody could have three times as much in the bank because they tithe, or that you had more money because of tithing, why wouldn't everybody just tithe? Tithing is to support God's work. It is not, I don't see anywhere in the Bible that it says you're going to have more money. You're going to have more blessings. God will pour out blessings, but blessings are not necessarily money. Now, there are some people that have more money. That may be their form of blessing. Anyway, since I'm talking about tithing from that aspect, I think there's also the aspect that tithing teaches budgeting and how to use your money and priorities, so therefore there is much benefit there that if someone didn't tithe, yeah, maybe they do have twice as much money as they would have. Because if they didn't learn the lesson of tithing and budgeting and putting money in savings and whatever, it might all be gone. So, you know, there's all kinds of ways to approach that. The number one way is to approach God based upon the fact, what do you want me to do, God? And because we serve God, because we love God, we want to serve Him. The reward may come in the millennium and in the resurrection as far as a major reward. There should be reward in obedience itself. Do we want our kids to obey us just because we give them $5 every time? You know, after a while, if you do that, you will find that there is a point of diminishing returns, that then they won't do anything unless they have a financial remuneration for it. And they warn, you know, you warn parents in child-rearing principles to be careful that you don't abuse the aspect of payment for services, or after a while, you will ruin the very desire to obey. Because there's only one reason they're doing it then, not out of service and respect and commitment to the family. It's for money. So he says, we go on in chapter 2. Speak now to Zerubbabel and to Joshua, to the residue, which is the remnant of the people. Some work had been done. We're in the seventh month, 21st day, so we've got almost a whole month. So some work had been done. We have basically a message of encouragement in verses 3 through verse 9. Basically, encouragement to them to keep building. Why? Well, you know, there had been some that previously had been upset that this temple wasn't as great. Ezra 3:12, now realize that this goes back in time to the laying of the first foundation, and they were upset about the first glory and second glory. It still stands that there were individuals here in 520 who had seen the first temple in its fantastic glory, that now were, maybe they were dragging their heels or they were making disparaging comments. Oh, well, this is nearly as nice as the first one was. You know, how can we, you know, take pleasure in this? So you have that same attitude that keeps coming out. God is really addressing that. Who is left among you that saw this house in her first glory? And how do you see it now? Is it not in your eyes in comparison of it as nothing? He says, yeah, there are some that they feel very negative about the building because of that. Yet now be strong, O Zerubbabel, says the Eternal. And be strong, Joshua. Be strong, all you people of the land, says the Eternal. I am with you, says the Eternal of hosts. So this building, this second temple, was very important to God. He is supporting it. He is telling the people to keep building. So he says to grow firm. This statement, be strong, is very similar to what he told Joshua, the first Joshua, back in Joshua 1, verse 6 and 9, to take courage, to grow firm, to be strong, to stand with God, because God had a calling for them. He had a calling here. He wanted this house to be built. For I am with you. Maybe again a reference to the previous prophecy, chapter 1, verse 13. He had said, I am with you. Again, he repeats, I am with you. According to the word that I covenanted with you when you came out of Egypt, so my spirit remains among you. Don't fear. Exodus 19, verses 5 and 6. God said that there were to be a holy nation. A holy nation. And he, of course, had promised to dwell among his people. To dwell among his people. Exodus 19, verse 5, 29. Exodus 29, verses 45 through 46. Exodus 33, verse 14. Isaiah 63, verse 11. We will find a similar statement in Zechariah 4, verse 6. Okay, so he said, don't fear, for thus says the Eternal of hosts, yet once, in a little while, I will shake the heavens and the earth, the sea and the dry land. I will shake all nations and the desires and the verb shall come is plural. So therefore, desire would be desires, plural, of all nations shall come. And I will fill this house with glory, says the Eternal of hosts. The silver is mine, the gold is mine, says the Eternal of hosts. So therefore he says, you know, if you were there in that particular time, you'd start building this building based upon a prophecy from God, you're kind of down because a month has gone by and there's some real negative people around you because they saw this first one. Well, this isn't going to be nearly. It was impossible to be nearly as strong and as glorified as the first one because they don't have the gold, they don't have some of the implements, the ark, I think, had been taken. There were so many things that were missing from it. You know how it is. You can get down in what you're doing and just say, oh, why should we even be doing this? It's not nearly what it ought to be or what it would have been. Let's just quit. So the Word of God comes to them and say, look, take heart. Be strong. I want this building built. This building is important to me. Oh, it may not be as glorious physically as the first one, but there's something that's going to take place within this building that is much more important than what took place in the first one. And this desires, the desires of the nation, which is the desire spiritually, I mean, one major desire of nations is for peace. For, we then draw the spiritual analogy, for eternal life, for that peace that comes to mankind, that yet once, that there's going to be some occasion, some great thing that happens in the future. And that may be, you know, how would they have taken it at that point? Perhaps there is an element within this that he was going to bring nations to it. There was going to be an element of prosperity that would come to Judah as the house was built. Then, at this particular time, we just mentioned, in the course of this, what was going on in Persia and in the kingdom about leading up to 520? There was a civil war going on where Pseudo-Smerdis had taken over, and then Darius has to get rid of him in 522. He has to go through the land. He has to bring peace to the land. And here in 520... which is still right at the end of the Civil War, there's a statement that there's, you know, going to, there's all these problems going on, and yet he will bring gold and silver glory to this house. Undoubtedly, they may have seen, and perhaps this is part of the meaning. Because again, he's writing to Zerubbabel and Joshua. He's giving them strength for the work that they're doing. Let's please not get so involved that we think that everything was written just for us and that there wasn't some strength and some things that they learned from it, which in turn, of course, we can learn also. I mean, that from that aspect, it's for us that they needed to do. So the conflict of Darius with the nations may be, you know, part of this as far as the shaking the heavens, the earth, the dry land. Undoubtedly, we see in duality in the future a shaking of the lands and the heavens and the earth before the day of the Lord. So we might say the sixth seal of Revelation 6 is going to much more fully keep that. So what I want to emphasize is the duality through these verses, and at the same time not de-emphasize the fact that God is giving this word to those people, and of course, you know, the great message it then gives us to us today. And the desire of all nations shall come, I will fill this house with glory. What took place then? If we go back to Ezra chapter 6, well, I guess I already read it to you, but 6 verses 6 through 8, it talks to the Samaritans that they had better leave the work of God alone. Verse 7, let them build. I will make a decree that, you know, that it's to be built, and the silver, the gold, you know, the goods were supposed to come from the king's treasury. So in part, this was fulfilled in Darius' time because it was built. 515, it was built. There was gold and silver that came to that land. That's not the only thing that we didn't get out of these verses, but I think we need to emphasize what was taking place then. The glory of this latter house shall be greater than the former, says the Eternal of Hosts. And in this place will I give peace, says the Eternal of Hosts. Okay, we see two aspects again. First of all, to them, that building that was extant then is the same building, however refurbished on the outside and rebuilt by Herod, but it's the same building that Christ was brought to. That Christ, who was the desire of all nations, he is the answer to mankind's problems. He was brought to that temple. And there are scriptures that can be tied into that. I don't know if I brought that with me or not. If I've got that in this, well, and we're about out of time, let me give some of that to you. I've got that here. I thought I had it right here with me, but maybe I've got it back at the office. I'll bring that in on Monday. Let's just finish this up as much as we can. In the book of Luke, it talks about Christ as the desirable one and coming and the glory of Jesus Christ. We cannot underestimate the glory of Christ in coming to that temple. Is it also future? Yes. It is also future. Verses 7 through 9 can be taken as far as through the church, that the church as the holy temple. Again, this is an analogy that can be drawn. That is very true. Ephesians 2, verses 17 through 22. That Christ brought peace to the church through his sacrifice. So, through the church as the holy temple. And then finally, it is fulfilled through Jesus Christ coming to that temple, the church, establishing a new temple, etc., in his second coming. So you have the aspect of that temple that was built then, that there was a purpose in the building of that temple, that Christ would come in his first coming, You have then a second temple. Let me see, how do I want to word this? We get first and seconds. Okay, so let me go back a step. You have the first temple of Solomon. It was built with great glory, the Shekinah glory, all these things that you get in 2nd-year Bible, all that was in it. It's then destroyed because of disobedience. God decided that there needed to be a second temple built that was greater than the first, but physically was inferior to the first. How was it greater than the first? Because God was guiding and directing the people, and that Christ would come to that temple. That Christ was going to come in the existence of that temple. Again, Christ then comes to that temple as he was the God in the first temple, Solomon's temple. Christ comes to that temple. The people reject him again, just as he was rejected in the first temple. People reject him again, and that temple is destroyed in 70 A.D. Christ will return again to a temple. This time it's going to be to a spiritual temple, being the church, then to establish the millennium. Okay, I think we'll end with that. I might bring in just a few scriptures, I think, that tie in this aspect of Christ and the glory of Christ. You could, you know, look it up yourself too, I suppose, and Luke and whatever. What I want to do then next time, let's see, how far did we get here? Chapter 2, verse 9, again, a promise of peace. Was there any peace that came to the first temple? Someone want to? I mean, if we're talking about first fulfillments and latter fulfillments, or we're talking about partial fulfillments and full fulfillments, was there any partial fulfillment with peace coming to that temple? Okay. Yeah, but you're going back in time. I'm talking about the second temple, the temple of Zerubbabel. James? Maccabees had, in 142, they had peace. That is one way that can be looked at. There was, and in fact, it was the temple that was built around that. The temple was desecrated by Antiochus Epiphanes in 168 to 167. Okay? It was then restored 165, 164, that year overlap, 3 years later. That it was cleansed by the Maccabees, and then proper religion was restored. There was a certain amount of peace. Total political peace came then in 142. But total, you know, for at least for a few years, 142. So an element of peace to that temple. I think there's another aspect, and that is a spiritual peace that came to it, and that Jesus Christ came to it, that Christ died, that Christ then appeared to the disciples as they were gathered together after his death. I mean, Christ said in John 16, verse 33, I bring you peace. I mean, Christ brought peace in his first coming. He says, I leave you this peace. He said, you're going to have persecution in the world and great trouble, but this peace I leave with you. And that's the fact that Christ overcame the world, that he died for our sins. I mean, there is that aspect, that element of peace. So again, we see partial fulfillment. We see a message that came, first of all, to Haggai, or through Haggai and Zechariah, to Zerubbabel and Joshua. They build this building. They see the hand of God working with them as God's people. We see also then the many messages that should ring through to us, the responsibilities that we have as a temple, as we see the New Testament application of the temple of God, that God continues to work through a temple. The temple now is not a physical temple. As Christ said, they're not going to worship in Jerusalem and whatever the day comes and whatever. I mean, he let them know there's a transition that's taking place from the temple there to the temple in the church now. Okay. We will pick up with that. When is the test? Monday. Okay, so we'll pick up.